passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Collazo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. And Peter, what's going on, man?
Not much. I'm doing well. The only March Madness I'm concerned with is the SEC slate this weekend and the rest of college baseball. So I'm locked in.
Well, I would almost go that far with you, but I can't lie. I've been following my heels. I think they have Wagner pretty well tucked away as we're recording this podcast. So always nice to avoid the dreaded one seed upset in the first round. But I'm with you. I mean, I was just reading your what to watch for piece that you do every week on the site, Peter, and it feels like this weekend is absolutely loaded with fun series, competitive series, highly ranked teams. And obviously a lot of these also are pretty laden with draft prospects as well. I am down here in Baton Rouge for LSU, Florida. I've been very excited for this series since the calendars were released. Honestly, I circled it as a potential get to in-person game, just given the team's quality in general, but specifically with Jack Caglione, with Tommy White, with a lot of the arms, Luke Coleman, Thatcher Hurd. And these teams have tons of talented underclassmen beyond the headliners for the 24 class as well. So I'm very excited to see the SEC home opener at the Box this weekend. That should be fun. Jack has been phenomenal, and I think he's pretty solidly in the mix at the top of the draft board. So that one will be fun. But it was a pretty busy week for us this week on the site. On the draft side, we had our first in-season mock draft of the year, which it's a March mock draft. So take that with a grain of salt, kind of read into that what you will. I would say my process on that end is mostly just trying to get the players that make the most sense in the ranges that make the most sense. It's far too early to have any confidence in specific player team links because everyone is casting a pretty wide net at this stage. But we also rolled out a top 300 draft board. So that's an update and an expansion. And Peter, we talked about this all throughout the offseason, but I think the movement on the board kind of lived up to the hype we were giving this class in terms of how wide open it is, how chaotic the draft board is. I think we had a third of the players in the first round range who moved up or down double digit spots, and just that amount of movement in the first round and all the movement throughout this list, it feels like a more substantial movement than previous years. Although I think the March update is always the busiest since we're kind of folding in the first looks at in-season performance. So just general thoughts on the mock, on the update, on this weekend. Take it however you want to go.
Yeah, I mean, well, first starting with this weekend, I think you've got, for me, like Florida State at Clemson is the series I'm most looking forward to. Number 7, Florida State. They're the last undefeated team in the country at 19-0. Clemson's 18-2. Their only real head scratcher was a random one-off 18-1 loss to Kennesaw. Other than that, they had a really their one loss came against a Jonathan Santucci led Duke team. I really like the lineup and depth across the board there, but it's going to be hard to compete with a rematch of the national championship series from last year with Florida at LSU that you'll see in person. It's chock full of prospects on both sides, and then also just it's in a high profile SEC series down at the Box, and that environment is really, really tough to compete with. So it's a loaded slate this weekend, and it actually started, I guess if you're listening to this on Friday, it started yesterday, and we'll see what happens with Mississippi State and Texas A&M tonight. Hagan Smith toes the rubber against Auburn. And as always, there's just going to be a ton of action across the board. But turning the page to the draft stuff, the 300 was outstanding, and I think that the key point that we've been harping on and have been making now for really months is how volatile it is, not only at the top but throughout the draft board as a whole, and we've seen that both in the new 300 and then in the mock. And I think right now, like, you can make an argument for, like, man, maybe 3 to 5 of these guys to go 1-1, closer to 5 than there are three guys, I think, that are 1-1 candidates right now. Like, I know who I'd take 1-1, but I would certainly hear you out on any of the other candidates. Like, Charlie Condon has not so quietly thrust himself into that conversation. Jack Caglione is a one-of-one type talent at the college level. I might not take him 1-1, but he is a one-of-a-kind talent. Travis Bezzana, I'd take him 1-1. I think he is the probably the best hitter right now in college baseball, and he's gotten somehow more explosive since last year, and he's tapped into that borderline plus power to the pull side. It wouldn't grade out as plus as a whole, but to the pull side, it's borderline a 60. And then the race for SP1 between Chase Burns and Hagen Smith is going to be really fun to follow. And then even the guys after that that are going to follow suit, kind of more outside the top 10 and into the late teens and early 20s, like there are a lot of fun prospects to monitor there as well. So I think it's only going to get more exciting as the conference slate heats up and we get deeper into the cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it has lived up to the expectations we kind of had for it just in terms of the sheer chaos. I will be curious how this class is viewed on draft day in terms of talent. We kind of entered the year with maybe a little bit lower expectations of the group as a whole than a typical draft class. Part of that, it was interesting talking about the draft update with just some people on the staff. Matt Eddy mentioned that his bellwether for a good draft class was a lot of high school talent and shortstops specifically. And I think we were kind of aware of this heading into this update. But after the kind of updated order was locked in, I just was scanning down the list, looking at some different demographic things. We only have 5 high school players ranked inside the top 30. And I promise you guys, this is not a function of Peter just loving college players and and loving the college game and shoving all of my precious preps down the board. It really is just a light year for high school players at the very top of the draft. I think there's probably an interesting conversation to be had about some pretty intriguing depth on the high school side beyond like the first round. But again, like, we just have 5 players ranked in the top 30 on the high school side. The first 18 players on the board, 17 of those players are college players. The only exception is Connor Griffin, who is also the sole high school player we have inside the top 10. It is shaping up to be an exceptionally college heavy first round. And I was just kind of asking around, talking to a bunch of scouts as I was working on this, but seeing just like how bad this high school group is. And I asked a number of scouts and each one of them said it was the worst high school class that they've ever covered. You have to go back a long ways to find a draft class that had less than 8 high school first rounders. 1992 actually is the only draft. There are only a handful of drafts that have had 10 or fewer high school players picked in the first round. We're tracking for this draft class to be in that group. It's 1992 had 7, 1984 and 1988 had 8, 1981, 1985 and 2008 had 9. And then the 2005 draft had 10 high school first rounders. It's looking pretty likely at this stage. I guess things could change once the northern states really fire up. There's a chance that you get a few pop-ups. But it's really tracking like this class has a chance to enter that rarefied era of some of the weakest high school, at least in terms of draft day capital. Where these high school players are going, there's always a chance that we look up 10 years from now and there are some players who were taken later that just turn out to be great players. But there's a non-zero chance that this winds up being the least high school heavy first round ever, which feels crazy. Obviously, teams have been kind of trending towards taking more college players. Player development has changed at the minor league level that has discouraged maybe more high school projects. But even then, like, typically the first round high school players are not your super long-term projection types. They're the Max Clark, Walker Jenkins, Corbin Carroll types who are just going to move pretty quickly. So I just thought that was fascinating. I think it's just random and kind of one of these fluctuations and waves of talent that you have. I don't think it's anything systemic or anything that we should be expecting for the future based on the work that Ben has done on some of our underclass high school lists. 2025 and 2026 look pretty exciting. And I'd say entering this 2024 class for the preps for a while, we were probably expecting it to be a little bit down. So that's fascinating. If you're a fan of high school players in the first round, this is probably not the year for you. But I know for a lot of general managers or owners who would prefer to take a college player anyway, just given the proximity and a little bit less risk in those profiles, typically, maybe that's good news. And Peter, I'm sure you would not be at all disappointed to see maybe a record level college first round.
No, it's certainly interesting to see how it's going to shake out. I think right now there are four high school guys that if I were picking inside the first round, I'd use a first round pick on, and it might be a hot take with where I go with it.
Yeah, let's hear it. I'm very curious to see which of those four you're in on. I might have five, but I'm always a little more excited to take on some high school risk. So I'm curious who your guys are.
I've got Connor Griffin, very unsurprisingly. He's one of the toolsiest players in this year's draft, regardless of prep or college. Mm-hmm. Like the upside here is tantalizing. It's a big league body. It's crazy, crazy high ceiling. I just think you got to really, really love it to take him in the range in which we have him ranked top 10 or so. But I do think someone's going to pull the trigger on him there. It's going to be really hard to keep passing up on him. I would take William Schmidt, probably my favorite high school arm right now, unsurprisingly as well. Like fastball's been up to 98. Hammer breaking ball that he locates well, 2+ pitches. He moves really well for a 6'4 kid. Still only going to be 18 years old.
Outside of Billy Amick, William Schmidt was the biggest up arrow player who's currently in the top 30 picks. So he's been trending really well this spring.
And it wouldn't shock me at all. And I think that you said this on last week's pod. It wouldn't shock me at all. And he's ranked right now, I think, at 19. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if he goes even higher than that as we get closer and closer to the draft. Bryce Rayner is another. I know he's been swinging it well this spring. I can't get off how he looks on the mound and the arm talent there. I think it's just super, super exciting. It's easy velo, great arm action, excellent athlete. I think if he gets in the right org, it's going to be it's pretty, pretty exciting clay to work with.
Yeah.
And then the last guy that I'd take in the first round is Cam Caminiti, left-handed pitcher from Saguaro High School. Great athlete on the mound, fastball up to 96. I like the upside as well with Caminiti. He's got good feel for spin. So those are the four guys. I think the one that I left off, maybe surprisingly so, was PJ Morlando. When you talk about the first round, you got to really, really love a guy to give him that much money, especially to sign. Yeah. And with Morlando, I like the bat and the hit tool. And the hit-power combo is legit. And then after that, you kind of have to start looking a little bit deeper. And that's not to say the offensive profile and bat isn't really appealing. It is. I'm just not using my first pick in the draft on it.
Yeah, no, that'll make sense. I think I'm with you on three of the, or actually all four of the players you said you would be in on in the first round. I think I would also be in on. Morlando is an interesting case. I feel like he's one of these players we had really high coming into this draft. He was kind of neck and neck along with Caleb Bonnemer with Connor Griffin for top high school player in the class. Morlando, Bonnemer, Kade Arambidi, the Texas catcher, all these guys to varying degrees have gotten off to slow starts or gotten slightly negative or down arrow feedback, I would say, from the industry. In our latest update, I think the industry is scrutinizing the first base corner outfield profile of Morlando. No one seems to dislike the bat or power combination, but I think the way you described it is how a lot of people in the industry are kind of wondering about him. And when you're comparing him to a guy like Billy Amick at Tennessee, who has been surging up boards, and you maybe have more of a chance for him to play on the left side of the infield, and you have his track record against SEC pitching, it starts to get a little easier, I guess, to side with that college profile. The one player that I would add, who I'm just utterly fascinated by at this stage, and this sort of player checks a lot of boxes that I like, is Kellen Lindsay, who I believe we talked about in a previous podcast briefly. Mentioned him as one of the buzziest risers, maybe a pop-up player. I believe Kellen Lindsay would probably fit the pop-up player phylum We have him right now at 31 on the board. He is the by far the biggest rising entrant on the board who was not ranked on the 200 on our preseason list. Everything I've heard about him this spring is utterly exciting. He is a top of the scale runner. He is a multi-sport athlete who played football for his Hardy High team last fall. And this spring, the reports on his defensive ability at shortstop are just tremendous. And he is really fitting into this player profile that this class just doesn't have a lot of. We don't have a lot of talent in Florida specifically. We don't have a lot of talent in, I should say, high school talent in Florida, like the typical talent you see out of the state. We don't have a lot of shortstops in general, and we don't have a lot of really impactful athletes who you can feel confident about sticking up the middle. Even if Lindsay, for whatever reason, and I haven't heard a single scout in the last 3 weeks or so be anything other than highly convicted that he's going to stick at shortstop, he has the tool set to stick in center field. The bat to ball skills have been impressive. He's not the biggest guy in the world right now. The name Trey Turner is thrown around a lot with Kellen Lindsay. I don't know if that is like the greatest comp in the world, but the fact that it's been thrown around as often as it has, I think should tell you a little bit about how excited the industry is for a guy like Lindsay. And I think in this draft class, when you're really looking for those profiles, once some of the elite hitters go off the board, once some of these elite arms who have actually shown an ability to start and throw strikes, once those are off the board, I get really fascinated with the upside of a guy like Lindsay. Even if you do have the risk of maybe a little less track record at high profile events, you don't have the same summer track record with Lindsay as you did with a guy like Tamar Johnson, who you could feel really confident about the offensive profile. And when you factor in just the athlete he is, that's a player that I would really want to bet on. And depending on how the first round fell, how these college players finish up conference play, he starts looking really appealing. And I think maybe transitioning into another area of this draft, Peter, and something we can address next, unless you have another direction you want to go. There are a lot of pitchers who are kind of fighting in this back third of the first round range, guys like Ben Hess at Alabama, Trey Savage at ECU, Luke Holman at LSU, who maybe had a little bit of a hiccup, but otherwise has been phenomenal. Josh Hartle in this range now for the exact opposite reasons, just with how poor he's been to start. It's feeling like there are a lot of intriguing college arms. And I also feel like in general, the tendency is for college players to move up the board throughout the season and for high school players to slide. Teams just feel so strongly about the performance of college players. And as the draft gets closer, those profiles just become so coveted. So I'm curious what you think about how the college pitching specifically is shaping up at this stage.
Yeah, well, first with Lindsay, I admittedly didn't know a ton about him until you started getting these rave reviews back on him. So I dug a little deeper, but I echo everything you said. I think the key point here with him is the likelihood of him to stick at a premium position, whether it's center field or shortstop. And we're looking at the high school class outside of Connor Griffin, and I guess Bryce Rayner to an extent, if a team believes enough in the bat. He's kind of the top guy right now who is a slam dunk to stick at a premium position. I really like the hands at the plate. The contact ability is obviously advanced. Love how he moves both in the outfield and on the dirt. And even if he doesn't hit for enough impact or if the power only ends up being average, I think the hit tool's got a chance to be plus if it isn't already. So I think that's a very, very intriguing profile. And he's also a football player. The athleticism is off the charts. You mentioned a top of the scale runner. Like, is assuming he performs and continues to perform this spring, it would not shock me at all if he's like a back of the first round comp round type pick. I think he's trending more towards a first round selection at this point. But flipping the page to the college pitching, it's a really interesting cluster of arms that you brought up with Josh Hartle, Ben Hess, Trey Savage, Luke Holman. I guess even Thatcher Hurd you could throw in there, and to an extent, Ryan Johnson. Though I think even if he ends up in the bullpen, it's a pretty loud fastball slider combo. But sticking with the arms that are more up the board, Trey Savage right now is probably my favorite of those, and it's pretty close between him, Hess, and Holman. But I'd take you Savage right now. He's got a workhorse frame at like 6'5", advanced strike thrower, track record of performance. at least one plus breaking ball, fastballs plus, the split change in the outing I saw, flash plus. I think you're getting a really high floor type of guy, and one that I feel pretty convicted on pitching in the big leagues one day. I think he's probably a number three starter, but again, I'd probably take him in the first. Then I'd go with Ben Hess, really interesting fastball profile, another performer in the SEC. Holman, like you said, he had that one hiccup, but one that doesn't affect how I feel on him from a draft standpoint. And then also how he's performing this year. It's a 4-0 record, I think an ERA of 0.65 or 0.63. He's throwing strikes. It's starter material.
Mm-hmm.
And then Josh Hartle is probably the guy that I would take last out of them. I know that you got a tough look at him.
Yeah, I feel like anyone who's watching the spring has got a tough look at Josh Hartle. He just has not looked himself. And when the command is not really locked in for a guy who's throwing 90 and facing some good lineups early in the season too, you're going to get punished. So I'm really curious to see if he's able to turn it around, because last year it feels like he looks like a completely different pitcher. So I'm not entirely sure what the issue has been with Hartle, but yeah, if you're not putting up the results and you're a command-oriented pitcher, the command doesn't look there, the stuff hasn't taken a jump. It's just been kind of odd to see for a guy like him. And again, I think I've mentioned this on this podcast, but I think I've seen him three times in the last year or so in person. And every single time, it's just not been a good look. So he's going to be a guy that's challenging for me specifically. I think entering the year, he was viewed as a relatively safe starting pitching profile that you can take at some point in the first round and feel confident you're getting a big leaguer. I'm not sure how much leash he's going to get from scouts if he keeps putting together the sort of performances he has early in the season. It's a 20% strikeout rate, still a really strong 5.5% walk rate, 6.26 ERA in 23 innings. He's allowed 16 earned runs in that stretch, and he's given up 32 hits, which you obviously don't want to see. So we'll see what he does. I don't think Wake has changed their starting rotation to this stage, but Chase Burns, who's going on Saturdays, has certainly been better. You mentioned earlier that he's kind of battling Hagen Smith for SP1. I'm not sure if you change that at all if you're Wake, if it's fine, if maybe if it even is beneficial to have Burns going on Saturday just to spread out some of the bullpen arms that you might be using, but it's been a bit odd for Hartle, to say the least.
Yeah, you summed it up well. I think at the end of the day, it's still good clay, not to beat that phrase into the ground, but you've got a 6'5 left-hander who's going to start. He is an advanced strike thrower. I know he hasn't flashed the pinpoint command and control that he did in his first two seasons, but it's still plus. But man, like, the stuff is really lacking. And I know, like, this fall got me excited. It was he had allegedly added a couple ticks to his heater. The stuff had taken a step forward. It kind of looked like we were going to get final form to a certain degree of Josh Hartle. And it's been a little bit of a slog for him the first month or so. And he's not getting a ton of swing and miss really with anything. Most of, like, he's not missing any bats with his fastball right now. And it looks fat to opposing hitters. I think according to Synergy, at least on his fastball alone, which has been 89, 92, touching .300, hitters are hitting almost .350 against it. They're punishing it to all fields. And I'm kind of curious to see how he's able to right the ship and just how ACC play continues. But right now I know that he's still slotted somewhere in the 20s, perhaps early 30s, but I might be a hot take, but he's more like, to me, like late second to mid third round type guy right now for me, and trending a lot more towards the third than he is the second. I just, man, taking that with one of my first two picks, at least right now, I need someone to sell me on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them, all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, let's keep moving around the board here. Another player demographic I'm kind of intrigued by are these college third basemen who we have in the middle of the first round and back of the first round. Again, to varying degrees, these players have performed and started slow. I think with the performers, you've got Cam Smith at Florida State, who has been pretty tremendous. I don't know if his hitting streak is still alive, but I know for a while there he was getting hits in basically every game. He's hitting 476, 543, 756. The strikeout rate is significantly lower than it was in 2023. It was nearly a 30% strikeout rate last year. Again, you mentioned this a lot with Florida State. They have not played the toughest schedule so far. I guess we can be a little bit more... Well, we'll have to wait and see what Cam Smith does against like the bulk of ACC competition to see if this is like truly a significant approach change. But I'm starting to feel pretty confident in it because we did see it throughout the Cape. We've seen it so far early this year. The setup looks a little bit different. He's clearly making more contact overall. So even though I want to see him do it against better pitching, there has been a change there with the approach. Billy Amick has been tremendous. He started getting some late first round buzz several weeks ago. And I think even this past week, like hearing his name floated about in the middle of the first round, teams that sound really intrigued by just the power, the exit velocity numbers he's putting up, just the massive bat speed he's providing. Right now he's hitting 377, 456, 818 with 9 home runs and is also posting pretty solid strikeout and walk rates. And then the last one that I would include in this third base group is Tommy White. We started him out on the year in the number 10 spot, figured fairly likely to go in the first half of the first round. That is really not looking as likely as I would have imagined. And there are some scouts I talked to that really don't think of Tommy White as a first rounder at all. I know recently he's gotten on a hot streak, but it's a bit slow of a start for him by his standards. He's hitting 321, 414, 536. He's got 5 home runs, been on a little bit of a home run binge, still really not walking a ton or striking out a ton. That's kind of what Tommy White does. He makes a lot of contact. He swings a lot. So I'm excited to see him in person this weekend. But how are you viewing this third base grouping? Is there anyone that I left out that you would view kind of in the same tier of prospects? And how are you lining up these guys and thinking about their changes or what they've shown early this spring?
Not to keep going into my own little like breakout session with these sub rankings, but I'd probably tier them as Cam Smith of that group. Cam Smith one, like you said, it's a big league body. I got a really good look at him numerous times this summer on the Cape. The contact ability has improved. The chase has also remained pretty steady. The approach has also remained steady, and like, the hit tool is trending up in my mind, but I'm curious to see if he's able to tap into a little bit more power, because I think when you're looking at this profile and also drafting someone this early on, I think with Smith, like I'd love to see him impact the ball a little bit more as we get into conference play, and he's going to either.
Yeah. Finding the balance between that added contact without sacrificing all the raw power that he does have, I think is obviously the tough balance to strike, but something that I hope he'll kind of figure out throughout the season.
Yeah, it's a tough happy medium to find, as we've seen with Vance Honeycutt. But with Smith, it's a plus arm over at third. There's really little concern that he's going to not be able to stick at the position. But again, like it's going to get a lot tougher as he gets in ACC play with the arms that he's facing. And this isn't to discount anything Florida State has done, because on paper, I think they're an Omaha caliber team, but that's a discussion for another day. But like the arm talent that he's faced to this point has, I mean, it's just not been great. So as he gets into the meat of ACC play, and this weekend he's going to see two really good ones, and Tristan Smith and Aiden Nock on Saturday and Sunday. Austin Gordon on Friday is also a good arm, but Smith and Nock for me are the two guys, Tristan Smith especially. So I'm curious to see how he does this weekend and as ACC play rolls on, because there's going to be no easy weekends for the most part. And then Amick too, I know there are some warts there with the miss and chase, but you're buying the power, you're buying the bat speed. It's a super strong build kid. I know he went in depth on him either last week or a couple weeks ago, but to me it's no doubt plus power. I've been a little bit encouraged with how he's looked defensively. He's by no means a gold glover, he's not a plus defender, but he at least looks solid average over there. Does he stick there long term? I don't know, but I am very convicted on the power ability. It's just a matter of, you know, how much is he going to hit, is how much is the chase and the miss, how much is that a hindrance? But no doubt plus power, easy plus bat speed. It's a quiet yet explosive operation. He doesn't really sell out for his power. So I'd have him two, and then Tommy White three. And it's not necessarily a knock on White, and as more so it is an endorsement of Amick and Smith. Like, White and Amick, I think, are neck and neck. I know White, the warts are pretty similar with what they have been. Like, he isn't, it's a pretty ultra aggressive approach he chases, but the barrel skills I think are really good. It's potentially a plus hit, like 60-60 with power and hit. I don't know if I'm super convicted on the six hit, closer to a 55 maybe for me, but it is plus power, but I think that he does end up at first base eventually as a first base DH type, more so than like Smith. I have no concern about him sticking at the position. Amick a little, White a lot. So I think that that is what gives Amick the separation, and then what also separates Smith from the two of them.
Yeah, the defensive piece is interesting. I think I'm maybe a little bit more bearish on Cam Smith as a defender at third base. I would put him in a similar category as Billy Amick in my mind, but I would agree with you that Tommy White seems like a pretty direct move to first base pretty quickly in pro ball. I've not really talked to many scouts who think that he's a long-term third baseman. In the mock draft that we did on Monday, I had Cam Smith at 16 to the Marlins. I had Tommy White 19 to the Mets. And then I had Billy Amick 22 to the Orioles. Like, I think even if I did a mock draft today, Tommy White might be further down the board. It is just a bit jarring to me hearing about him potentially not being a first rounder, though, just given some of the player profiles that I view as similar who have gone in the first round in better draft classes. And I'm just curious how much Tommy White's college production and bat to ball skills and raw power are going to be negated by some of the profile concerns. Like, I mentioned this in the mock draft that Seth Beer in 2018 went 28th overall. It just feels odd to me to think of a guy like Seth Beer as being a first round talent and not Tommy White, who I think has had more impressive college numbers and I think is also a better athlete. Although when we're comparing Tommy White to Seth Beer, it's a pretty low bar in terms of athleticism. Beer was like notoriously poor in that department and with all of his secondary skills and tools. So I will be very intrigued to see how the scouting community, if there is consensus on Tommy White, he does seem to be shaping up to be a pretty polarizing profile. Overall, there are a lot of people who just don't want to take a first baseman, right first baseman this high, kind of similar to the conversation we had with PJ Morlando, just skepticism in the profile. And then there are also scouts who are like, you know, there are warts to the profile, but the bat is real. And what he's done at the college level, the power that he's shown, just having the confidence that raw power and those bat to ball skills will translate to the next level and you will get some sort of impactful hitter, even if it is at the bottom of the defensive spectrum. Just that conversation and that piece with Tommy White, I think, will be fascinating. And I think he's also a prime candidate to heat up and really get going. Maybe that's already happening to one degree or another. I'm curious if you think he's flipped the switch, but it has certainly been different for him being the focal point of this LSU offense so far. And I'm not sure if that's been a challenge. You could maybe speculate that that's part of the Nick Kurtz conundrum as well. We haven't even talked about, I think, the injury news with him that happened in between our last podcast. But both those guys kind of got off to slower starts coming into the year with pretty high expectations for their teams and being more of a centerpiece in the lineup.
Yeah, I think with White, similar to Cam Smith, he's got a chance to make himself a lot of money as SEC play rolls on. It's going to, I think when all is said and done, someone's taking that in the first round. Like you said, it's, you can make the argument that it's 60 hit, 60 power. I honestly think he's a good looking athlete in the box. And I say that like he moves well in tight spaces. I know it doesn't look crazy in the field and it doesn't look as sexy on the dirt, but I do like the operation of the box. The hand speed is the trademark, but he knows what he's doing. I like the two strike approach where he just goes completely wide base, gets really deep in his stance, lets his hand work, and he's still able to impact the ball. Like it's mm-hmm. super strong. He's a super physical kid with big time wrists and forearm strength. I think that, like you said, the track record of performance is outstanding. He was a guy as a true freshman that was being talked about, and granted this was when he was a true freshman, but as someone that was like top five, top 10 overall pick type in this year's draft. And I think that unless he falls completely flat in SEC play, he's going in the first round. I don't know where it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be in the top 10. I don't think it's going to mm-hmm. be even in the first half of the first round. But yeah, in that 20 to 30 or so range, like he's, someone's taking that.
Like, yeah, I just feel like at a certain stage, once the elite hitters come off the board, once the elite bats are gone, like how many other players can you look around in the country and feel as confident about what they can provide offensively? And I guess depending on what happens this year, as long as he stays healthy, he should be near the top of like all-time college home run leaderboards, just given the production he's had. 27 homers in 2022, 24 homers in 2023. He's been one of the more productive home run hitters that we've seen in college baseball in a long time. You could maybe pick nits in that argument, just given the kind of homer environment that we're in right now, but still he's been one of the home run leaders in this really homer happy college environment that we're in. So that one will be fascinating. And I think that even if the consensus on him in the industry is not that he's a first rounder, it really only takes one. The highest team on a player is going to take him, and that's where they're going to go. He's not going to get picked where his consensus value is. He'll be picked at the upper end because that's the team that's taking him, obviously. So we don't necessarily need every team to think that, but I just feel like at a certain point on draft day, again, barring injury or something really imploding with the season, at a certain stage, the offensive profile is really appealing. So
big time. And I know he doesn't have like the wood. He has really no college performance with a wood bat, which is a little unique in today's day and age, like no USA, no Cape. But he'd perform well with wood, and he'd hit for power with wood. So I think I think
his high school track record even would be enough to.
Oh, like, yeah.
He was hitting with so much power as a high schooler at the time. I think people probably didn't realize how good of a pure hitter he was, but I saw him hit for power with a wood bat. His ability to send the ball far with like that, that's not a huge concern, but it is an interesting point too, that he really doesn't have much summer track record at all to speak of.
Oh yeah. He's not a hot bat merchant like some of these kids are that are still swinging like alloy bats. But so no, I guess like long story short, I'd take him in the first, if I'm picking 20 to 30 or so, more like honing in like 23 to 24 to 28, 29, I'd feel comfortable popping him.
All right, Peter, I wanted to ask you about injuries to JJ Weatherholt and Nick Kurtz. We haven't been able to talk about JJ Weatherholt really at all because his leg injury happened very early on in the season. I think it's just four games that he's played this year. Mm-hmm. He's been out. It sounds like he's still going to be out for a while. Nick Kurtz recently went down with a shoulder injury. These are two guys who, entering the year, we had 1 and 2, some of the more complete offensive profiles in the entire class. JJ Weatherholt, maybe the best pure hitter in the class. Nick Kurtz, just the combination of hit, tool, power, approach. We've talked about these guys ad nauseum. Would you be concerned with these injuries? I've been kind of asking this question to scouts throughout the industry and just trying to get a feel for how teams are assessing these guys and how far they could actually fall given the medical. There are not a ton of examples of players in recent years who have kind of dealt with injuries during their draft year to compare them to. Really the only one I can think of, and please correct me if there are other ones that I'm just forgetting, but Nick Madrigal being injured and missing I think a month, maybe a little bit more than a month, with a wrist injury, and he really didn't fall at all. I've kind of been thinking of those guys in the same way. I would be surprised if they fell too far for these injuries, unless there is some real concern for teams to think that it's an injury to the same body part and some reason to think that it's going to be a consistent issue for them moving forward. And even then, given this year's draft class, I don't know how far those two can fall given the quality of the hitters that they are. What are your thoughts on how you're viewing them now and when we should expect them to be coming back if we know?
It's an interesting conundrum here because hamstrings are really tough. They're nagging. Weatherhole has dealt with this one since the summertime, which hindered him a little bit on the Cape. It hindered him at USA. I have no doubts with the makeup. Like, he probably wanted to play through this, would if he could. So I think that speaks to the nature of the injury. Like, hamstring on the surface doesn't sound crazy in one of those like buzzwords or body parts that you kind of wince at when you're hearing.
It doesn't feel as scary as elbow or forearm tightness or shoulder with pitchers. For
exactly.
Sure.
It's just like an annoying one, but those things linger and they linger for a long time. I think that right now I really believe in the bat. The profile is the profile. I'd still probably take that top five. I'm less convicted on it now than I was on opening day just because he hasn't played and the injuries have continued. But Weatherholt, not a ton. Kurtz a little bit more, like it's a shoulder. And, you know, shoulder issues are never great. He's dealt with injuries and I think definitely last year with Wake. I don't know if he did as a freshman. I don't want to say yes and speak out of turn when he didn't, but certainly last year and this year he's dealt with injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I question a little bit the durability. And again, you're talking about a shoulder here, but apparently whatever he had done and whatever like imaging was done, if it was even imaging, it came back pretty encouraging because Coach Walter talked to a Wake reporter. I forget what his name was, but he wrote an article on it and he seemed pretty encouraged with the report. And it doesn't sound like it's going to be a major severe injury that's going to keep him out for very long. But, I think in Kurtz's case as well, like not only the injury, it's kind of looked like in the box, he's like pressing a little bit and I don't want to, and I get it. Like, you come into the season with a ton of buzz. The team as a whole hasn't really lived up to its expectations. You feel like you got the weight of the world on your shoulders and you got to kind of do it yourself when you don't really have to. He's still taking his walks. When he connects, it's as high quality impact as you can kind of find, but I'm curious to see if he's able to flip that switch like Tommy White was seemingly able to do last weekend when he comes back and ACC play gets rolling, teams start to attack him more. I think I'm a little more, not worried or concerned, but I'm a little more wary about Kurtz. I don't know if I'm as convicted on him as I was going into the season as a top like 10 pick. I still think he's a top half of the first rounder, but some of these guys behind him are getting more and more appealing as the season progresses.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a combination of these guys being hurt, and with Kurtz, you have the combination of the injury and also just the quiet start to the season offensively with guys performing. I mean, Chase Burns and Hagan Smith, both of them have leapfrogged Kurtz on our update. They've been phenomenal. Braden Montgomery is another one who has just played himself up the board. I don't think his name has been really mentioned too much around 1-1, but I don't know why he wouldn't be in consideration there with guys like Condon, Bazzana, Caglione, both the pitchers. He's been phenomenal. He has a lot of impact. He's hitting well. He gets on base. Yes, he doesn't have the up-the-middle profile. A lot of these guys really don't have that profile, but I don't think you can really look at Braden Montgomery and feel anything but more excited about his potential to be an impact right fielder than a guy like Charlie Condon, who is the most buzzy 1-1 name right now, if you're not in the Travis Bazzana camp like you are, Peter. And I would say, like, when putting together this draft update, talking to some teams who are picking at the top of the draft, just kind of asking them how they're viewing the top tier. And a lot of this feedback was prior to the Nick Kurtz injury, so I'm not sure how much it changes it. That's something I've been trying to get clarity about. But there is some sense that there's a group of eight names at the top, and that includes Condon. I mean, it's all the eight names on our board. That's why they're the top eight names on our board. Condon, Bazzana, Caglione, Weatherholt, Burns, Smith, Montgomery, and Kurtz. And I think maybe the injury slides Kurtz out of that, depending on how you think about it. But until I hear that specifically, he's kind of in that grouping. And then after that, you get into a group of players that I think the opinions probably start to diverge a little bit more often. But it's still like we still have this wide open 1-1 case. And I think guys like Condon and Bazzana are going to need to keep performing to establish themselves there. And it'll be fun to see. But I wouldn't say that like right now Charlie Condon is in the spot that Dylan Cruz occupied entering the year. Like there's not nearly that sort of separation in this draft class, but it has been fun to kind of see how it's unfolding so far.
Yeah, and I'm with you on Montgomery. I know it's really not a hot take at all to say that you really like him given where he was coming into the season, given what he's been doing now, but he's someone that like personally is probably in my personal top five. Like it's plus power from both sides of the box. I like the left-handed swing a lot better. I like him left-handed better, but you're certainly not gonna
I think that's been his lefty swing, it feels like it's been better really since high school. But the fact that he can do both is a nice little cherry on top, I suppose.
Yeah, like you're not gonna make him a left-handed hitting only guy, at least right now or in the near future. But he's also it's plus bat speed. It's again, it's easy plus power. He's a good athlete in the field. I think he moves really well. It's the closest thing we have in this draft to an 80 grade arm. I think it's a, like you can stick a 70 on it. I don't know if you can stick an 80 on it, but like it's right there. It's a premium arm. No doubt we'll stick in right field. The hit tool continues to really improve. The bat to ball skills have improved. The approach as well, like the chase, he continues to cut down on year over year. Like the stuff that he has needed to show improvement on, he continues to get better at, which I think is a good check in the positive box for him. I know when you look at their schedule, it is like outside of a series with Florida and a midweek with Texas, but like midweek, you're not seeing anybody. It has been it's been a very light schedule. So SEC play is going to be a different animal, but if he continues to do what he's doing in SEC play, showing that improved hit tool, continuing to hit for power from both sides, the explosiveness isn't going to change. The bat speed isn't going to change. The raw power he's got isn't going to change. The athleticism and arm isn't going to change. So if he continues to perform, that's someone who I think ends up going in the top five when all is said and done. It wouldn't shock me at all.
Yeah. All right, Peter, I think those are the only names I really wanted to bring up. But please, if there are any players that I have not mentioned that you wanted to mention here in this conversation, by all means, have at it. Otherwise, we can get into some housekeeping, take a look at what's ahead, and hop out of here and get ready for me, LSU, Florida, and for you, I guess, everything.
Not to keep the listeners on here for a while and not to keep you hanging, but two more guys, three more, and we can get more into them next week and beyond. But Carson Benj is another one that I'd take if I had a first-round pick. I know it might be a lukewarm take at this point, but I love the profile. He's not to go too in depth on him. I'd take him in the first round. I really like him a lot. Walker Yannick at Sam Houston State is another one that
he's been really good.
Yeah. I know that he probably doesn't get a ton of national recognition and a ton of national play being at Sam Houston State, but rather quietly, he's hitting .432 right now with 8 doubles, 6 bombs. Good defender behind the plate. It's a plus arm, borderline plus power. When you're talking about the college catching, I think he is like Loma Vita is still my top guy as the first college catcher. And then after that, I don't really think Walker Yannick is that far off from catcher number two, at least for me. I know that it's going to be tough given the, like he doesn't play in a Power 5 conference. It's not the SEC. It's not the ACC. And he's not going to see Pac-12 pitching. But he's kind of quickly approaching catcher number two for me. And then James Tibbs at Florida State. I don't know if...
You're a big James Tibbs fan.
Yeah, I really like him a lot. I like first-round labels. I don't want to be like giving him out like candy on Halloween. But he's another guy that I really like. To me, it's 6 hit, 6 power, 6 arm and right, 55 maybe, but I think it's closer to a 6 than a 55, at least for his arm. The bat to ball skills are great. I think he's got right around a 90% in zone contact rate this spring. consistently on the barrel, drives the baseball with authority to all fields. The pitch recognition skills are advanced, picks up spin well. Like, there is serious plate coverage with power, which I think is what you want to see. And again, another like cherry on top for him is he does have that track record with Wood. He was flashing this type of power with Wood. He hit well. I think he hit over 300 on the Cape. And again, really looked comfortable in the box. And I do think he ends up sticking in the outfield and sticking in right field long term. So you couple that with the fact of how well he's been performing this year, and if he continues to do so as ACC play rolls on, that's someone when you start talking mid-20s, early-30s, and looking at some of these other names, I'd probably take him over. I take him over a lot in that like 25 to 35 range. So those are three guys that I like a lot. Tibbs and Benj, especially Yannick, in tiering college catchers, I'd probably go Loma Vita 1, Cozart 2, like Yannick 2B. Like, I think it's that competitive. So curious to see what happens as the cycle rolls along.
Yeah, some of these FSU hitters will be really interesting to see once they kind of get into the meat of it in ACC play. So definitely look out for all these names. Peter, thanks for your insight today. You guys can check out our updated draft list on the site now. You can check out our mock if you have not already checked that out. I'm assuming if you listen to the podcast, you looked at that on Monday when it came out. Because if you're listening to a draft podcast, you're probably pretty pretty into your mock drafts as well. Peter, what do you have lined up that people need to know about that you have coming? For me, it'll be notes from this weekend's LSU Florida series, hopefully good looks at Jack and Caglione and Tommy White specifically, but really any kind of prospect nuggets that jump out this weekend will be on the site for me next week at some point, in addition to our normal college hot sheet for the top 20 performers in the country that we both put together, if that's right. Sounds wrong, but that's right.
Yeah. Every Monday, top 25 plus team capsules with the esteemed Teddy Cahill. Tuesday, hot sheet with Carlos. And then each Thursday, my pretty beefy what to watch for piece. And then,
which I'd highly recommend if you're listening today and you're still kind of getting settled in for weekend preview, or you haven't watched college baseball yet, or really you're just getting a late start to it. That piece is a really good primer for the series you should be paying attention to, and just great context on the team situations and what's happening. It's I would say must read every week.
I appreciate it. That's a big label, but I got that on coming out every Thursday. And then the college podcast and draft podcast on Thursday and Friday, respectively. And then it's looking like April 4th, I'll have a very initial top 50 ranking of 2026 college guys. Like, the 2026 draft, saying it's eons away is almost like that's saying it's closer than it actually is. But it's going to be less so. Like, they will be ranked, but it's take it with a severe grain of salt, because at this stage, it's just kind of getting 50 of what I think to be the right names down on paper, and then a little bit about the player. So
yeah,
it'll be fun to release that in the coming weeks.
Yeah, that'll be good. Cool. Thank you guys for hanging out with us. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Thanks for subscribing to Baseball America. It's been cool hearing some feedback from you guys just on Twitter about the show, just enjoying it, liking the coverage and the content. And some of you have even reached out and said you're subscribing to BA and giving it a try because you like the podcast. So really appreciate that. If you have considered subscribing to BA because of these podcasts, we've got some people who have done it and seem to be enjoying it so far. So you might find yourself in that bucket. But thank you again. Thanks to all the BA supporters. And for Peter, I'm Carlos. We'll see you guys next week.